Hello, and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations Live, where we give you an insight into some of the inspiring programming events held at The Conduit. The Conduit is a collaborative community dedicated to building a just, prosperous, and sustainable future. In this episode, Kelly Falconer, the founder of the Asia Literary Agency, is joined by Ukraine's most famous novelist, Andrei Kurkov. They explore his new book, Grey Bees, a dramatization of the conflict raging in his country through the lens of a mild-mannered beekeeper. A timely treatment of the unfolding crisis in Ukraine, Grey Bees illuminates one of the most bewildering of modern conflicts with Kurkov's signature humor, imagination, and sensitivity. He is a wonderfully charismatic individual who came to life on the stage. Here he is with Kelly.
Before I go on, before we started this session, I said to Andre, you know, I want to talk about your novels and your life as a writer and your books, and then we'll talk about politics later and the war. And he said, no, I want to start with the war and end with the war. So, but first, would you tell me a little bit about your background and what, you know, how your evolution as a novelist?
Good afternoon or good evening. Thank you for coming here. And my problem is that when I start talking about myself, it can take half an hour or 45 minutes. I'm used to very long monologues.
I'll time you.
I need a very strict moderator, I mean, presenter who can stop me. But anyway, because I'm already 60 years old and I have a lot of things to say. I was born near Leningrad. My father was military test pilot. But in 1962 or 63... the Caribbean crisis happened, and my favorite Soviet politician of Ukrainian origin, Nikita Khrushchev, decided to show the world that the Soviet Union is a peaceful country, and he announced first unilateral disarmament. 100,000 officers were dismissed from the army, demobilized, and my father was one of them. And that's how the family moved to Ukraine, because my grandmother lived in Ukraine after the war. She was a frontline surgeon during the war, and she ended the war as the head doctor, head surgeon of frontline hospital, train hospital. She was a tough lady, a Stalinist, and after the war she was the head doctor of the sanatorium for kids with tuberculosis. So we moved to her house, and we stayed there. We lived until we got a flat from Antonov plane factory. Probably you know the Antonov planes, which produced the biggest plane in the world, Maria, which was recently, 3 weeks ago, destroyed by Russian army. And I grew up actually in the house filled with books and atlases for surgeons, for medical books. That's why I have so many medical fantasies in my books, yeah. In fact, actually, the quality of medical books in the Soviet Union was much higher than the quality of children's books. I mean, the pictures were brighter. That's why, actually, my sort of strongest impressions in childhood were cancer tumors and bullet wounds and the methods how to operate them, etc. Well, I grew up in a normal Soviet family, one can say. My father was then test pilot after he stopped being in the army, and he died only 3 years ago. He was 92. I'm very happy he didn't live to see the war with Russia that we have now, because he probably would die from heart attack. He was for a long time nostalgic about the Soviet Union, but I mean, in this age, people are nostalgic about their youth, and his youth was Soviet, and actually he was very happy to be a pilot. He was a proud pilot, and he was honest communist who refused career so that people wouldn't think that he is using his party membership to become a minister of aviation or something else. Anyway, I had lots of hobbies as a child. First hobby that influenced my life was cacti. I started growing cacti at the age of 7 or 8, and I was member of Cacti Lovers Club in Kyiv. And at some point, I had collection number 7 in Kyiv, in a small flat in Khrushchev's house. Some people probably know what is Khrushchev's house, 5-story small similar flats, 45 square meters, together with the kitchen and everything else. And thanks to cactuses, I started learning foreign languages, because I realized that every cactus has, just as any person, name, surname, and sometimes patronymic, and it is in Latin. So I started learning botanical Latin, and I knew the translations of the names of cacti. And then I learned Polish in order to read books which were not published in Russian or Ukrainian, but they were available in Polish translations. Then I started studying English, and the result probably is very good, because I married a girl from Surrey, and I in 1988, and I refused to settle in Britain, and she agreed to move to the Soviet Union, and we lived there ever happily ever after until recently. But she is in Ukraine at the moment, and with our sons, and they refused to leave the country. So what else about my... I mean, I started writing poetry at the age of 7. I started inventing political and non-political jokes under influence of my elder brother, who was a dissident, at the age of 13. And I went from poetry to jokes, from jokes to short prose, from short prose to novels, from novels to trilogies, but I wrote only one trilogy, thanks God, and nobody wants to publish it in English because it is 2,000 pages, but it is published in Italian and in German.
Yes, and publishers were biting their hands off to get your novel published, your first novel. They couldn't wait to publish your first novel.
Are you sure? It took in fact, actually, for 18 years I was sending I was actually writing every day novels, short novels, short stories, and I would spend every day 2 or 3 hours making synopses of in English, then my CVs, and making copies of these letters and samples of the chapters in English. And I was sending this also through my Polish friend. I mean, he was smuggling out my manuscripts and sending them from Tarnów, from Poland, to the publishers worldwide. He would receive rejections from all around the world to his address and smuggle rejections to me. And I think I have the biggest collection of rejections in Ukraine, about 600. And it took me 18 years, actually. And what happened with the Death and the Penguin, when I wrote it in 1995, I also did... it was already post-Soviet time, so I didn't need to smuggle something. I could use post. We didn't have yet faxes and emails. And I printed 40 copies of CV, synopsis, and first two chapters in English, and sent them to different American and English publishers. And from England, I received my favorite rejection ever on this book, and it was very short. Dear Mr. Kurko, unfortunately, we are publishing only quality literature. We are wishing you good luck elsewhere. Then I made 40 more copies of the same sort of package of information and sent to continental Europe. And then Swiss publisher Diogenes wanted to read the original. I sent the original, and 3 weeks later, I already installed fax machine at home, and I received a fax, like 7 meters fax, which was a contract in two copies. And I read it, and I didn't know what to do, because, I mean, they were offering me a huge sum, 5,000 Swiss francs. And I suddenly got nervous, because I realized that if I sign it, does it mean that I should send any more letters and packages of information about my books, and what I will do with the time that will become free? But of course, I mean, I signed, and I went to meet the publisher, who turned out to be a friend of Federico Fellini and Friedrich Dürrenmatt. Unfortunately, he is already dead, Daniel Kehl. But anyway, we met, and he asked me to learn German so that I could present this book in German-speaking space in German. And I learned German, and from 1999, the book was published in 1999, I was presenting it in German. First 2 weeks, actually, I was reading extracts in German without understanding what I read. And then I was trying to understand the questions, but very quickly, actually, I became fluent in German, and now I do a lot of events in German, not now, but from 1999. Yeah, and actually what happened, the book was published in March 99. In June it became, got into first top 10 books in Switzerland, then in Germany. And then Swiss publisher decided to buy world rights for this book. And the publishing house in London that publishes only quality literature started buying rights, English language rights from a Swiss agent for my books, including starting from this one, yeah. So I'm a happy man. I wanted to become a professional writer. I became a professional writer at the age of 37. I'm still a professional writer, so I'm mostly I'm fed by Penguin Misha, but some other characters also contribute to our family budget.
So, I mean, it makes J.K. Rowling's rejection list seem, you know, paltry, really paltry by comparison. You know, you talk about in that learning German. I think perhaps your language training at the Foreign Language Institute, perhaps.
Well, I studied English and French in the Foreign Languages Institute and Japanese in this translator school.
Okay. There's a line in Graeby's where you talk about the main character goes to a funeral for a man who he doesn't know, one of the villagers, and he feels he can't understand anything. He can't understand the language per se, but he feels the language on his skin. And I thought that only a linguist could, you know, use a kind of, you know, a description like that of how the way a language feels and the fact that you understood it without really understanding the words themselves. So I want to talk about Misha a little bit. You talk about
that's also the name of my brother.
Okay. So we're here to talk about Graeby's and other things, but I wanted to, my father was a milkman. I used to say that, but really he was. He came from a family with a long history of farming and worked in the dairy industry. And when I saw the review in the Financial Times in 2011 of Milkman in the Night, I had to read it. And it set the scene, if you will, for these next few books I read for tonight's event. As reviewer novelist Marina Loewicke wrote, you create a world where happy endings are unlikely, but still sometimes happen, no less in Tsarist or Soviet times than in present-day Ukraine. And Milkman, like Death and the Penguin, is populated with animals who are as important to the plot as the human characters. So can you tell us a little bit more about the animals?
Well, I mean, it's true, actually. In fact, I published 24 novels already, and there is only one novel, one or two, without animals. One, because the main character is Ukrainian president, and then when you have a president, you don't need other animals in the book. And the other one is actually a matter of life and death. It's a strange, actually, a short novel where humans behave like animals. But generally, I think why I have so many animals in the books, why? Because as a child, I had some pets. I cannot say many because then I will feel guilty. But anyway, all my pets, when I was a child, they died tragically and very often because of my neglect or because of other situations created by me. So, I mean, this is subconscious. I repent subconsciously putting the animals in the books and giving them second chance of life.
It's interesting that you talk about your great aunt. Was it your grandmother? No, your grandmother, who was a surgeon.
Grandmother. Yeah.
And so many of the women in your characters are very strong women, and it's one of the kind of the solace that some of the male characters find in the strong arms of these women who help them perhaps, you know, lift the beehives onto the back of the truck. And your main characters are surprised by their strength and they feel, you know, great attachment to these women as well. So as per your guidance, To prepare for tonight's event, I read Death and the Penguin, then Graybees and The Bickford Fuse. I had already read Milkman in the Night. But The Bickford Fuse, I'm still contemplating, and I'm glad I read it in that order, as I spoke to you earlier. Of the four novels I've read, Bickford, The Bickford Fuse is the most dreamlike or a nightmarish, depending on your point of view. Here's The Bickford Fuse. It's the most allegorical and complicated. It reflects, as it does, on the society you're commenting on. In your foreword, you note that it is about Soviet man, who is neither bad nor good, but simply Soviet. It explores his psychology, the nature of his thoughts, and his nation. The Bickford Fuse, described, as I'd say aptly, by Sam Leith in the Financial Times, is a sort of cross between The Pilgrim's Progress, Catch 22, one of my favorite novels of all time, Heart of Darkness, and The Road. And in The Bickford Fuse, we have a barge filled with dynamite, manned by two sailors, floating on an unknown lake, the endless taiga, is that how you say it? Taiga. An airship filled with warmth and which never needs to land. A searchlight perched on the back of a truck or a lorry, as you might say, that is out of petrol. It just continues to roll and roll, and whose beam shines on nothingness. So we have characters in this novel who are lost and who are searching, but for what they don't really know. And as the title might indicate, and I found this resonated with your other books, this is a novel about light and dark, shadow and sun, of color and black and white, of silence and noise, of the memory of music, of a wooden bell that captures the wind and hums with a low reverberation as wind sounds through the trees, maybe, or as you might blow on the open top of a bottle to make it sound. I felt even a kind of thickness. The pace is slow, relentless, confusing at times, and disorientating. This is your favorite novel, and I understand why. But I would say it would have been a difficult one to start with, and though I highly recommend it. You have to be in the kind of headspace for it. And it's as if you've set the scene for this novel with the works that came before. Would you expand?
Well, first of all, I wrote this novel from 1984 till 1989, still in the Soviet times. And what happened that in 1980, my grandfather died, who was Don Cossack, also a Stalinist, and he was ex-husband of my grandmother, Alexandra, who was a military surgeon. Both were very tough personalities. And only after he died, I found out that his two brothers actually were sent in 1937 to Gulag. And one actually survived 25 years and then settled in Irkutsk in Siberia. I don't know the destiny of the other. And I realized that all the Soviet history that we were taught was complete lie. And I started looking for more information. And I was hitchhiking in the Soviet Union, river hiking, traveling, and I was looking for so-called important pensioners, because, I mean, there was a special title in the Soviet times if somebody occupied important position in the past and then retired, he would be called пенсионер союзного значения, sort of the retired person of all union importance, of regional importance, etc. And I was looking for them and pretending that I'm a student of journalism, and I was trying to interview them. And actually, before that, I was a student at that time, and we had an American professor who gave me a great present, a small dictation machine, which weighed only 2 kilos. And I was traveling with this and with cassettes. And I managed to find some of the retired important personalities who were ready to talk. But then I realized actually only those who suffered after death of Stalin, they were bitter and they could tell me the real stories. Everybody who, I would say, was retired in a good situation, they were silent when I was asking about 1930s, 50s, the fight against cosmopolitans, then anti-Semitism of Stalin, etc. They didn't want to talk. And once I found a real treasure, one can say. I found an old man in Crimea, near town of Sudak. This man, he was a night keeper of the parking space belonging to the sanatorium of police. And by accident, actually, he said that he was one of the special prosecutors starting from 1935. And he was dismissed from his job in Khrushchev's time. And since then, actually, he had rubbish positions. So his career was finished. And I recorded about 12 hours of conversations with him. He was telling me how he was signing execution orders, etc. And at the same time, sort of, he was mixing these memories with his personal life. And his personal life was incredible in the sense that very early, as 18 years old, he decided that he will marry only a girl with the name Nadezhda, which means hope in Russian. And he found one girl he loved with the name Nadezhda. He married her, and then 7 years later, she died of something. And 1 year later, he found another Nadezhda and married her. And then also something happened. So he had in his life three Nadezhdas. And when I found him, he lived with a retired lady who was a naval officer in the past. A huge lady, probably 70 years old, with a very specific sense of humor. And her name was Galina. I was so much affected by these conversations with him that I put him into the trilogy. His name was Alexander Petrovich Smurov. And for example, I still remember how he told me that after 39, after Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, when Soviet Union seized part of Romania, but first actually part of Poland was taken. Then a gypsy girl was arrested crossing from Romania into Ukraine, and he told me that he signed an execution order for her because she was obviously a spy, but she was so beautiful and so young, so he felt sort of sorry for her life, but still, I mean, she was shot dead. And things, I mean, he was using these quite horrible words, not with a smile, but somehow mundane, in a mundane way, sort of something ordinary. And then, I found some other people. I was trying to understand the atmosphere of life at that time. And of course, these people were young, so they were enthusiastic. They were enthusiastic when they were actually signing sentencing people, etc. So they were sure that they are building a new society and that they are building something huge, and they couldn't even imagine what will be on this building site in the end. And the Bickford Fuse, I should tell you that actually the first time when I came here in 1988, I went to the London Library to patent department because I needed information on William Bickford, who is not known here except for Cornwall, where he lived. And he was a British engineer who invented fuse wire. And that's why fuse wire in Russian is called Bickford's wire. And I just imagined his life and his dreams and his nightmares and made him also a character in this book. So there are two real characters, Nikita Khrushchev, whom I would say I love not in a sincere way, but I feel some kind of sympathy and sorry at the same time for him. And William Bickford. Of course, I mean, there was another William Bickford who was British playwright and who is probably more known. Mm-hmm. But for me, a person, I mean, the mining engineer, William Bickford, was very important. Mm-hmm. And so it is British-Soviet novel, and I always just briefly explain that this is the history of evolution of Soviet mentality. And I thought actually I was writing about history, but in fact from this book you can understand the mentality which exists now in Russia, because I mean it's the same way. The cult of war, the cult of victory, which was supported by the Soviet system until 1991 and was resurrected by Putin in 1999. And what is happening now is connected with this cult of victory. Russia cannot lose any war. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think the war we have now, I mean, it will not be over in 1 month or 2 months. And it can be over quickly only if the person who started it dies of natural order or unnatural causes.
Well, the main character in this book, Kurtetsky, is that one of the main characters, Kurtetsky? He's one of the characters.
There are several.
He leaves the boat.
Yeah, the main character is Pavel Dobrynin.
With the Bigfoot part of the Bigfoot feet over his shoulder, and he, because he's sort of been abandoned by the captain, and the fuse that he leaves behind as he unspools is a sort of breadcrumb behind him, and he goes off on this journey for miles and miles.
Well, he goes from Japanese Sea to Leningrad, and it takes him 17 years. And he is trying to understand whether the war is over or not, and he cannot understand it. So he thinks that if he sees the enemy, he will light the fuse, and the dynamite behind will blow up and will not be used by the enemy. But then his idea changes, and he thinks that if he doesn't like what he sees, he will blow up the whole world. Course,
and nobody knows if the war is still on or if it's off. And I mean, I think this also suffuses Grey Bees as well, because in Grey Bees, your main character is living in this gray zone. It reminded me, of Philippe Claudel's Grey Souls, where the war is this constant kind of menace in the background. Let me just go to my notes. Of the novels that I read, I think Grey Bees really affected me the most, and it is sort of suffused with this, as I said, this relentless quest to stay alive and to endure, and also the joy in the mundane as well, or the kind of taking pleasure in the mundane, and I think. Grey Bees, which reminded me a bit of Philippe Claudel's Grey Souls, both set at a town at the edge of the war zone. The reverberations of the war, you know, suffuse the story with tension and sadness. And like Bickford Fuse, we have here again the silence. And as you write, the sound of the distant bombardment is integral to the silence. And this book, to me, is about a people who have grown accustomed to fear as much as they are able to grow accustomed to fear. And fear, as you write, is an invisible thing. It is about becoming used to the slow passing of time, of about those who live, but separately, contained, but with brief moments of affection and tenderness, its rarity the norm rather than the exception. You write that people, you know, die, people who die of fear die like most others who spend their lives that way, of a heart attack. And here also, I believe you remind me of Japanese writers or perhaps Norwegian writers. You know, you write so poetically about the mundane, as you were talking about earlier, about the simple act of existing, of enduring, as you do with Death and the Penguin. Endurance is a constant theme of the will to live, of the pleasures taken from the most basic things, a good meal, a beeswax candle, a tank full of petrol, the arms of a strong woman. But also, in Grey Bees, you use the bees allegorically. It is a reflection on existentialism. I love this novel so much, and I want you to tell us a little bit more about Grey Bees, its inspiration, and what you write about in the foreword, of course.
Well, first of all, I didn't plan to write this book. And actually, when I was asked whether I'm writing already about the war, I usually said I'm not going to write probably... not only until the war is over, but until 10 years after the war passed, and we can actually talk about this like about something that is in distant past. What happened that from 2014, we had suddenly in Kyiv lots of cars with Donbass number plates. And then that these were the rich people and middle-class people who moved to Kyiv at once after the beginning of the war. And then the poorer people from Donbass came in their Ladas or without cars. And suddenly you go to see friends, and there are people, resettlers or refugees, who are also friends of friends, and you talk to them. And one of resettlers or refugees who moved to Kyiv and opened a small cafe, he told me that he's driving every month to the front line, and there is a village abandoned by almost everybody except seven families. And they don't have electricity, gas, they don't have shops, post, police, nothing. And of course, and he's bringing them medicines and whatever they ask for, and they are thanking him with pickles and with things they make from vegetables. And he is selling this in his cafe, and very often they are bought by other refugees. And that's how actually I started thinking about gray zone. I realized that the gray zone always has the same length as frontline. And frontline in Donbass until recently was 430 kilometers. And this gray zone is actually the space between positions of Ukrainian army in Ukrainian case and the positions of separatists and Russian volunteers in Russian army. And in some places, this path or this strip of land is 80 meters or 100 meters. And in some cases, it's 3 kilometers, or it can take the whole district of a town, like Avdiivka is an industrial town, and part of it is inside gray zone from 2014. So actually I started researching a bit. I went not because of the book, but I went for other reasons 3 times to the frontline zone, and I traveled once the whole frontline along to the Russian border, to Severodonetsk. And I talked to many people who fled from Donbass. I talked to people who stayed on. At the same time, we had already about 200 books about the war in Donbass, but all these books were about soldiers. So Ukrainian hero soldiers and traitors and separatists. So there were no human lives and human stories told in these books. And I thought that this is not correct. I mean, we should give voice to those who decided to stay, because, I mean, people in Donbass, They are different, yes. I mean, they were under control of local mafia, local oligarchs, and they were influenced by Russia. I mean, Russia was financing and supporting Soviet nostalgia there. I mean, the most popular TV channel there was called, I mean, it is called Nostalgia, and it is broadcasting black and white Soviet television programs very often, black and white and color Soviet films, a lot of actually films about the Second World War. And, of course, this is an industrial zone, so you have a lot of proletariat and not so many intellectuals. And after 2014, this territory remained without any kind of elite. So, I mean, cultural, political, business elite either left for Russia or left for Ukraine. And so the territories were ruled by criminals, and some of the criminals now became local politicians sponsored by Russians, and actually some Russian specialists were sent on business trip there to organize life, because locals were not capable, those who remained. So for me, I mean, people in Donbass were always hardworking, stubborn, and they traveled the least in Ukraine. It was quite traditional for people in Donbass not to travel outside their small district or their region. Another thing is that we had always two clichés created by Ukrainian politicians, one negative cliché about people of Donbass and one negative cliché about people of Galicia of Western Ukraine. So according to these clichés, all the people from Donbass were bandits and thugs, and all the people in Western Ukraine were radical nationalists who were prepared to kill any Jew or any Russian speaker. I mean, both are lies, but I mean, Ukrainian politics is not something easy to explain, because, I mean, probably I should go very deep in the history. Not very deep, but I mean, first I want to say that the Russian mentality is very different from Ukrainian mentality. Ukrainian history is different from Russian history, and the war is also about the history, because Ukraine doesn't accept Russian version of Ukrainian history. Ukraine never had a royal family, never had aristocracy, never had a tsar, except when it was practically taken over by Russia. In 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, Ukraine was independent territory ruled by Cossacks without fixed borders, because all the borders were front lines with Russians, with Crimean Tatars, with Tatars, with Poles. And at the same time, Cossacks were running elections to elect their leader, who was called Getman, who was the head of the army and head of the territory. They were electing higher officers. They had diplomatic service, and in Istanbul archive you can find correspondence between Turkish Sultan and Ukrainian Getmans. There was a legal system, there were military courts. They were also corrupt, like today's Ukrainian courts. And Hetman Mazepa actually used one of the courts to get rid of his ex-friend, who refused to allow his daughter to marry Mazepa. So, I mean, in the history you can find lots of things. They are similar to what was happening recently in Ukraine. And Ukrainians, as the result, they are individualists. They are used to live in organized anarchy. Everyone has his own opinion. Nobody respects the Getman or the power or the rules. And of course, I mean, they never loved any kind of leader. So the result, we have the highest number of political parties registered in Ministry of Justice in Ukraine, 400 plus, which means that every Ukrainian who wants to be politically active, he looks around, he understands that he doesn't like any of the political parties that exist. He wants to be leader of the political party. So he registers his own political party. And then actually, when he doesn't have money to promote it, he doesn't know what to do with it. He keeps it sort of frozen, and then sometimes he sells his party. And a small party is very cheap to buy, $20,000, $30,000. Because, I mean, if you want to take part in local elections, you want to register your party, you cannot take part in the elections 1 year after the registration. But if you buy a party, you can go straight to the elections. So the system works like this. So, I mean, I want to buy a party, and you have a party. I come to you and say, you don't use your party. Can I buy your party? And you say, okay, let's do this. So let's have a general meeting of the party, and we will re-elect the leader. I will become the leader of the party. The name is the same, but I can change the name as the leader. And now I can revive this party and go with this party, or on behalf of this party, to become a local deputy, for example. I mean, I don't think it is relevant now, but this is completely different system than the system created by Russian mentality, which was also Soviet mentality, which is collective, which is based on the metrics of monarchy, where everyone loves the Tsar, and if people are fed up with the Tsar, they kill him and love the next one. And you can see from the history, I mean, before 1917, all tsars remained tsars until they were dead, killed, or of natural causes. And then in the Soviet Union, the general secretaries all were re-elected until they were dead, except for Nikita Khrushchev. And then now we had a brief change after 1991 with Gorbachev and Yeltsin. From 1999, it's one-party system. One Tsar who is re-elected and will be re-elected again until he is dead. And people are happy to have this Tsar, and they are proud that the world is afraid of them, and the world doesn't know whether Russia will launch nuclear weapon use or not. So, I mean, these two mentalities, I mean, of course, it's very difficult for them to coincide. And 20 years ago, the border between two mentalities actually was cut in Ukraine into halves, because practically, the policy of Russification, of removing Ukrainian language and introduced in Russian language as the main language of Ukraine. It was used also to promote Russian mentality. Lenin's dream was to create the society, the country with no ethnic roots. He said that we will not have Ukrainians or Uzbeks, we'll have only Soviet people, which meant that Soviet people can have only Soviet history behind, no traditions except the ideological, cultural elements of Soviet life. And
a little bit like Xi Jinping is doing for China now as well.
Yeah, but I mean, the same is done by Putin because, for example, there were problems in Kazan and Tatarstan where suddenly Moscow decided that there is too much Tatar language in Tatarstan, and if they speak Tatar, it will definitely lead to separatism. Mm-hmm. And actually, in Russian rhetoric, the Ukrainian nationalists are those who speak Ukrainian. If they speak Russian, they are okay. They are normal Ukrainians. But if they speak their mother tongue, they are nationalists.
I mean, I must say, like, with all, you know, every novelist, you know, is every novelist like you, I think it's political. What you're writing about is political, and it becomes more and more politicized as the situation, you know, changes. And, I mean, it's been sort of surreal reading these books as the war has unfolded and reading the newspapers and listening to the radio and watching the news and yet reading this alongside. And it's as if my education has, expanded, to a degree I never expected it to. But I think with all novels like... I remember reading about Myanmar, trying to do a lot of research, reading a lot of nonfiction about it. And then I read The Glass Palace by Amitav Ghosh, and then it all came together. And it just came alive, and it made me understand, you know, the nuances of it. And what you're not getting here, I suppose you might have got it a little bit from Andre's, you know, talk, is that the novels are funny, they're absurd, and they catch you off guard because, you know, they're full of black humor and you find yourself laughing at the most, horrific things. There's a part in, is it Bickford Views, where they're in the boat and there's a group of German, I'm going to give this away because it's very early on, the group of Germans who are like surrendering, and the captain of the boat goes, boom, and he kills them. And he's just like, it's easier. And he just sort of, it's a discard, like this chap that you met in the car park, right? You know, he makes it so oddly, you know, sort of common, a kind of common thing that almost happened as if it were, you know, killing a fly. But the way you write it is just so kind of funny. You find yourself laughing. You think, oh my God, he's just murdered a boat full of people who are trying to surrender. It's not funny. Before we move on to more politics, because we will, I wanted to ask you about two things in Grabies, lots and lots of things about Grabies, but one, Petro. It made me feel sort of, it's poignant. There's a soldier, Petro. So the main character in the book has, you know, they have very little electricity, and he has this mobile phone that he charges up when he can, and he's made friends with a soldier from the Ukrainian side,
yeah.
And he gives the soldier a meal and some vodka, honey vodka. And
no, the soldier refuses.
Because
actually the soldiers refuse to take stuff
duty
from locals because they think they can be poisoned.
So they make this connection, and then throughout the rest of the book, he just sends out this one text saying alive, and then Petro writes back alive. It's kind of moving, and then for a while he doesn't hear from Petro, and he thinks, well, he must be dead or something. And then eventually at the end we find out what happens to him. I won't give it away. And it's a really moving kind of thread that, you know, kind of is that pulls you through this book, the kind of the will to live.
I mean, the main character, from my point of view, a typical representer of Donbass people. I mean, he is hardworking. He worked in the mines. He's young retire. Well, I mean, like young retiree because of the professional illness. Mm-hmm. He's a beekeeper. He was left by his wife and daughter who didn't want to live in this village, and he didn't want to move to a bigger city. He lives with six beehives with his bees. And in this war, in the beginning, he defends only his bees. So they are kept in the winter in the barn, and they are surrounded by the pieces of metal in case shrapnel comes, yeah. And he sort of observes the nature, and for him, actually, nature is the main university. And he loves the bees because he thinks that the bees are the only beings that manage to create communist society. He also thinks that actually the only beings that created socialist society are ants, and people are hopeless. I mean, this is all mixture of sort of post-Soviet thoughts and feelings and understanding of life, yeah. And he dreams in the beginning of the novel that in the springtime, if the war is still going on, he will take his bees on holiday. He will. He has his larder also well hidden from anybody, and a trailer, and he will take them outside the war zone to Ukraine proper, controlled by the government, and find a place so that they could fly and collect pollen, and the honey will be sweet, because when he offered some honey to Petro, to the soldier, Petro said that the honey is bitter. And then Sergei, the main character, decided, well, that's because the fields where the bees are collecting pollen are filled with gunpowder, with burned gunpowder from the mines and from the bombs. So he's dreaming about this journey, the first part of the novel. And the second and third parts of the novel, this is already a road movie where he is traveling with bees and he is trying to find place for himself and for the bees. And in fact, actually, he is behaving also like a bee. He belongs to these beehives, but he's too big. But in his dreams, actually, he sees bees of human size. And then when he comes to Crimea, and next Crimea, because he once met a Crimean Tatar beekeeper during the beekeepers' conference 20 years ago, he decides to go there. And the Russians accept him as a victim of Ukrainian nationalists. And he silently agrees that he is a victim, yeah. And then he is engaged in Crimean Tatar life, which is very difficult there. And his old friend is missing, and his wife is asking him to go to FSB and to check on his destiny, because they will tell you, you are Russian speaker, you are from Donbass, they trust you. So he's doing this, and he starts looking for him, the body of this man is found. And I won't, yes. But anyway, he learns a lot about Crimean Tatar Muslim culture, etc. And then somehow, I will not give away, the beans get mixed up with the Russian Secret Service. With very unpredictable consequences.
And is there really such thing as a bee bed?
Yes, yes, and you can... I cannot tell you, come now to Ukraine and test it, but... you can find it anywhere in Ukraine, actually. People are lying. I mean, there are special, like, beds. You sleep on the beehives. And it's supposed to be good for nervous system and for calming down your state. I mean, because the vibration of bees is passed to your healing body. And then somehow it's considered healthy and it's very popular.
Yeah, I've read about that, the cats, the way they purr, that if you can get the body, you know, in that kind of vibration. How much time do we have? Are we here for another half hour? I can't remember what's going on.
We're getting close to question time.
Okay, yeah. But, just let me... before we do that, I mean, we'll go towards politics a bit and then we'll go to question time. There's a line in Grey Bees... where you say, the character says, what happened is what Putin says happened. Putin doesn't lie. And when did you write this? I mean, when was this written? I think it was...
This is in Greybeards.
Oh, it was in Greybeards. Oh, Greybeards. Yeah, sorry, Greybeards. I mean, these books
And this is actually the words said in the novel by a Russian speaker lady from Crimea who lives in the same village with Crimean Tatars.
So when I spoke to Andrei before this, he wanted to talk about... I don't know if you've seen his article in The Guardian. Was it today that it was published? Yeah. And Andrei, you wanted to talk about the culture war as well, and what is Ukrainian post-Soviet literature, and how has it changed post-Maidan, and what now, and what you said, what should writers do in wartime, and want to expand on that and talk a little bit about
that? Well, first of all, Ukrainian literature after the Soviet Union went completely different way, but there was a pause of 7 years in which we didn't have new literature at all, because, I mean, the potential writers were still not ready to write, and the Soviet time writers were not read anymore. And in this time, actually, the book market, which at that time still existed, we don't have it now, was filled with, first of all, with translations of crime stories into Russian from all the languages of the world. Then science fiction came, and then 1997, we suddenly got a generation of mostly young female writers and one young man writer who were writing for several years books about sex, drugs, and rock and roll because we didn't have this literature in the Soviet time. And suddenly in 2004, during Orange Revolution, this literature was gone, was not interesting anymore, and there were some novels about history, historical events in Ukraine, because history for Ukraine is very important, since in the Soviet time, the real Ukrainian history was not taught, was not published, and was not known. I'm not talking only about deportations of Ukrainians who didn't want to join collective farms to Siberia. I'm not talking about the artificial famine, but lots of other things were not mentioned. And the Ukrainian historians... some of them were trying to write real history. Some of them, as always, were trying to create patriotic history, adding myths to real events, etc. So, I mean, we don't have now a fixed history book that can be 100% true, but at least Ukrainians know much more about their history. And writers, of course, they were contributing by historical novels to both, to the truth and to the myths. And from 2013-14, the literature changed completely. It became very politically engaged, very militant. And what happened then, after 2 or 3 years over the war, suddenly we got, instead of one literature, two literatures. Because the war veterans, Donbas war veterans, started writing books themselves. And they were writing memoirs, diaries, novels, short stories. And today we have 400,000 war veterans. And they are very active readers, but they read only books written by other war veterans. And what was interesting recently before the war, that there was quite an open and loud conflict on Facebook between traditional writers and war veterans. And, I mean, some of the war veterans became best-selling authors, but the traditional writers were saying that they are lying. This guy couldn't sell over internet 35,000 copies of his book about the war. In fact, he did. His name is Valery Markus, and he was the first best-selling author from this generation. But we have already these war veterans writing not only about the war, but about everything else. So at the moment, actually, they are still separate groups of writers, but I think in the end they will be reunited they will turn into one society. But today we have writers who are fighting as soldiers on the front lines. We have writers who are in occupation. I am in touch every day with a lady writer who is in Melitopol, in occupied Melitopol, and she's in hiding because... actually, FSB agents are walking the streets with lists of names and addresses and actually taking people for interrogation, kidnapping people. Of course, we have some writers as refugees abroad. And majority of Ukrainian writers are now in Western Ukraine, just like everybody else. So, I mean, half of Ukraine moved to the West, but only 3.5 million of people crossed into Europe. The others are on the border or in Galicia near Lemberg or in Ivano-Frankivsk. They are waiting to see what happens and hoping, they hope that they will be able to go back. In fact, actually, some of the towns are freed already from Russians, but the government says the people shouldn't go back because it is dangerous and it's not clear, actually, how the events will develop further.
So you're the president of PEN in Ukraine, and you're traveling around a bit this next 8 days, partly as for PEN, I would guess.
Not exactly, actually. I'm doing fundraising for refugees, but also, I mean, we are collecting money for Ukrainian writers, and we are helping them actually with the money that we receive. We have the Belarusian actually PEN members set up an account in Poland for Ukrainian PEN, which we can use, and I mean, it's good that we have solidarity not only of PEN centers but of ordinary Poles, Lithuanians, and people who want to help refugees, but also writers. Yeah.
So what should writers do in wartime?
Well, I mean, I think that nobody is writing fiction now. I mean, I stopped writing fiction weeks before the beginning of the war. I write articles and texts, and I probably will publish a collection of these texts about the months before the war and the war itself, maybe in the autumn, and I hope that by the autumn the war will be in the past and there will be a huge task of rebuilding, destroying cities and towns and villages, but you cannot predict anything now. But I think many Ukrainian writers became sort of diplomats. I mean, they participated mostly in online discussions, and we are running in English online discussions. We had recently, and you can find it on Facebook, on PEN Center Ukraine page, for example, a dialogue with Margaret Atwood, Natalka Snyadanka, Ukrainian writer from Lviv, with Margaret Atwood. We started this series with my dialogue with Philip Sands, and it was very interesting conversation, and it is recorded and it is also on YouTube. So we are trying actually to publicize and to make the situation in Ukraine known in the world, and I think actually in Europe Ukrainian writers managed to publish a lot of articles. I mean, we have young writer Markian Kamish, who is a specialist. It's interesting because his first book is published now, I think, in English. It's about illegal tourism in Chernobyl zone, because he was illegal tourist himself for 20 years in Chernobyl zone. And now, I mean, he's very well known in Italy. So he is publishing articles about events in Ukraine every 2 days in Italian newspapers, yeah. And other writers are, if they are more famous in Poland, they are publishing, working for Polish media. This is now the task of the writers.
I mean, in all these books, there's a foreword, and there are also very few footnotes or endnotes that you can refer to. So again, you know, you learn about, you know, what's going on in Ukraine, and the forewords written, you know, several years ago are so prescient, you know, as if you predicted what was going to happen now. I suppose many people, you know, understood what would happen and just weren't, you know, didn't have the privilege of writing about it. And so thank you, Andre. And before you go, please join us on the 21st of April. We have Fiona Hill here, who's here, an amazing life story. She started out as a coal miner's daughter from Durham, and she ended up, as I said, as a Russia advisor to presidents. Fascinating, inspiring woman. And thank you for, again, Pranvera, thank you to the Conduit Club. And thank you most of all to Andre for, you know, spending this time with us. And please buy lots and lots and lots of copies. I cannot, you know, recommend these books highly enough. And off we go. Yay.
Thank you very much.
This event was presented with support from Conduit Impact Champion, Pranvera Smith. Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations Live. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. And to learn more about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.